the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
That's great. Let's read from the Bible together, shall we? If you've got one of these green Bibles, it's page 855. Whether you have or not, it's Hosea chapter 3, and we're going to read just five verses from the start of an Old Testament prophet called Hosea and chapter 3. If you don't know me, my name is John Allen. I'm one of the leadership team at Belmont. And if you do know me, I'd just like to say thank you very much on behalf of Anthea and myself for all of the concern and love and prayers and cards and everything else that we've been shown over the death of her father. It's been truly amazing, so thank you very much for that. It's great. Anyway, let's read from Hosea chapter 3 and verse 1. The Lord said to me, "Go show your love to your wife again, though she is loved by another and is an adulteress. Love her as the Lord loves the Israelites, though they turn to other gods and love the sacred raisin cakes. So I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and about a homer and a lethic of barley. Then I told her, 'You are to live with me for many days. You must not be a prostitute or be intimate with any man, and I will behave the same way toward you. For the Israelites will live for many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred stones, without ephod or household gods. Afterwards, the Israelites will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. They will come trembling to the Lord and to his blessings in the last days.'" That's all we're going to read this morning. This is Ariel McRae. She's become an internet celebrity over the last few weeks because she's a girl who's not got much money. She lives in Martin, Tennessee. She's at the University of Tennessee in Martin, training to become a teacher, doing all sorts of odd jobs to keep herself going. And as you can probably see from that close-up of her finger, she's got not just married, but also engaged over the last couple of months. And she's become famous because of a post that she put on Facebook. And I'll tell you a bit about it first. She found this guy on the internet whom she really was super attracted to, and she decided to get married to him very, very early because they were so sure about it. Trouble was, they had no money whatsoever. So he took her down to a cut-price jewellery store to buy a couple of matching rings for the engagement and the wedding. And she found, too, that they could just afford, I think it was $130 for the two. And just as she was trying them on with the assistant, another assistant from the shop came across and kind of casually said, "Yeah, you know, some guys will actually buy those things as engagement rings. Can you believe that? I mean, how cheap and tacky is that?" Blech. Great saleswoman. But Ariel said in her post on Facebook, "My husband-to-be, his face just fell instantly. And he realized that what he was buying me was just not what other people would buy. It was all he could buy. And he kept on saying after that, 'Are you sure this is enough for you? I know this isn't the ring you would like. Are you sure this will do?'" And she said on Facebook, "Y'all," she comes from Tennessee, "I would have gotten married to this man if it had been a 25-cent gumball machine ring. When did our nation fall so far to think the only way a man can truly love a woman if he buys her $3,000 plus jewelry and makes a public decree of his affection with said flashy ring? Sure, they're nice. Sure, the sentiment is wonderful. And I'm not trying to cut down any of your experiences, but when did it come to all that? Why do material possessions equate love? My husband was so afraid of me not wanting him because he couldn't afford a piece of jewelry. He was afraid that the love I have for him would pale because he couldn't afford the wedding set I wanted. The world has made it this way, and it's so sad. But here I am, though, courthouse married, $130 ring set, the love of my life by my side, and happier than I could ever imagine." And that post has just gone absolutely viral. There she is with a ring. That's the guy that's done it, made all the difference in her life. And that's them getting married in front of the courthouse just after it had all happened. The wedding dress is an unusual choice. Apparently her husband, Quinn, got it from the clearance rack at a cheap dress store, and it was all he could afford once again. 30 minutes after the wedding, the reception took place in a pancake house across the road. And it was just Ariel and her two best friends because her husband had to go back to work. So low-rent wedding in lots and lots of ways, and yet it's caught everybody's imagination. 45,000 times so far, her post has been repeated and quoted. It's in news stories all over the internet, and people are posting pictures online right now of their own hands wearing their own tacky rings. My ring's tackier than yours. Look, I got married with a Coke can ring pull and all that sort of stuff. That's great, isn't it? Because it's just making the point that love is not necessarily where you expect it to be. It doesn't necessarily follow the same form all the time. And sometimes people will do strange things in the name of love. We've been doing a series in this church over the last few weeks about Christmas called It's Not Your Birthday. And it's been about the fact that it's really Jesus' birthday. And when you look at what Christmas really is all about, we have to ask ourselves, what can we give to him? Not what can we get. And so we've had a few weeks of this series. Sarah Flint started on the 20th of November when there were still 35 sleeps to go to Christmas, according to her calculation. And she was talking about the fact that God gives Christians gifts to use, abilities they didn't have before in the same kind of way, gifts that they can use in his service. So how are we using our gifts was the challenge that morning. And then Si Richard spoke the next week about the fact that Christmas was an absolute miracle, the Son of Righteousness rising over a darkened world. And it's all about miracles. And God gives us the power to do miracles for other people, to change situations utterly in his name. Are we prepared to do that for somebody this Christmas? And then we had the third part from Derek, where he was talking about the messiness of Christmas and the way in which everything at that first Christmas, the illegitimate family, the flight to Egypt, the way that Mary and Joseph had to take on daunting challenges, the way that Jesus was associated with the stigma of illegitimacy too, all of that meant the first Christmas happened not in a nice, neat, well-ordered, tidy, conveniently swept and lighted stable, but in a mess. And God works in a mess. And are we prepared to be part of, in the mess of this world, helping people to find the reality of the living Lord Jesus? Okay, well, this one's called This Scandalous Love this morning. And we're looking at the story of Hosea in the Old Testament, because I suppose the biggest thing that God gave us at Christmas was the assurance of his love in an incredible new way through the coming of Jesus. We need to talk about the backstory. This is Hosea and his wife Gomer, at least as a 13th century artist pictured them. They look suspiciously 13th century to me in that. But anyhow, what's the backstory? The story of Gomer seems to be that she was a bit of a dodgy proposition to get married to in the first place. Hosea was a prophet. And prophets were often given jobs to do, which, by God, which kind of played out in front of people what God was saying to them. And when Hosea was thinking about getting married, God said to him, go and marry a promiscuous girl. Go and marry somebody who's not a good prospect. Now, it's hard to tell from the Hebrew whether it was go and marry a girl who's being promiscuous right now, or go and marry a wife who will break your heart. It's hard to tell, but it's more likely the first one. And so Homer turns up on Homer, what am I talking about? I'm thinking Simpsons here, aren't I? It's bad. Hosea turns up on the doorstep. Yeah, no, just take that picture of Homer right out of your mind, please. It's not going to help us this morning. It really is not. Anyway, Hosea, that's the guy, turns up on the doorstep of Diblaim, Gomer's dad, and says, can I marry your daughter? And Diblaim says, have you got all your marbles? And Hosea says, yep, and I'd like to marry your daughter. And Diblaim bites his hand off, because where on earth is he going to find a husband, a respectable husband, for this good time girl who's been going out with boys and doing strange things since she was a teenager? Oh, yes, okay, you can marry her. But do you know what you're getting? And she says, well, no, but God does. And so they get married. And at first things go fine, because they have three kids and it all seems to be settling down very happy. But Gomer has this wandering instinct. And one day she's just not there anymore. And there's an envelope propped up on the mantelpiece. Dear Hosea, it's been great, but I need freedom. I need the wildlife. I've gone back to my old friends. Sorry, three kids to bring up on your own. Never mind, you're a prophet, you can do it. And so she's gone. An awful lot of people would never have taken her on in the first place. And the first part of this story, I think, makes the point. It's scandalous that he married her anyway. Lots of people would have looked at her and said, whoa, she is not a long-term prospect. there's going to be heartbreak in the story somewhere because you just can't trust her. She's shown that with her whole career so far. There's no way. And Hosea knew because God had told him that the marriage was going to involve heartbreak. And he still went ahead with it. Then the story really gets interesting because God says to Hosea again, "You know Gomer?" He said, "Well, I know Gomer. You made me marry her. Now she's gone. Oh, good riddance to you." God says, "Go and get her back." Get her back? Yep. That's what you've got to do. Show your love for her by getting her back home again. And so Hosea goes and tracks Gomer down in the red light district where she's living and finds that she has sunk into a stage of prostitution where she's not her own person anymore. She's working for a pimp, I guess. And he's not about to let this valuable property go. And Hosea says and goes to him and says, "Look, I want her back." "Well, that's going to cost you." And so he pays all the stuff that you read about in that passage in Hosea. And you'll see that the footnotes at the bottom of the page don't tell you exactly how much that was. I mean, they say helpful things like, what was it I noticed? Hosea chapter 3. It's in here somewhere. Yes, it is. Oh, yes. A homer and a lethek. That's where I got Homer from. A homer and a lethek possibly weighed about 195 kilograms. I think, yeah, okay. And it doesn't tell you really, but the price he paid was a pretty heavy price. It's as much as you would pay for buying somebody out of slavery. And he paid all of that money, which he probably couldn't afford, just to set her free. And to another Israelite, that would have been absolutely scandalous. It was scandalous that he married her. It was scandalous that he bought her back. And having bought her back, she probably looked at him and said, "Okay, so what do you want? You've bought me back. Thank you very much. I'm free again. I suppose you want me to go away now?" "No, I want you back home." "You want me with your kids? Aren't you scared that they'll get contaminated by the wild, evil mum?" "No, I want you back home." "Oh, I see. Yeah, you bought me so you can sleep with me." "No, I don't. You're not going to sleep with anybody, and nor am I. We're just going to rebuild that relationship bit by bit until we're back together again, until everything's sorted, the wounds are healed, and we can be a family once more." And that was the third scandalous thing. Not just that he bought her out of slavery, but he kept on loving her. He just wanted her back. And to the Israelites in the Old Testament, looking at that story, that was absolutely scandalous. She was a wicked woman. Let her go. Now, why did God put Hosea through something like that? Well, it's dead simple. It's because of the way that Israel was in those days. It was strong. It was powerful. Hosea seems to have ministered to the two countries that had split away from one another, the kingdom of Judah in the south, that's the yellow blob there, and the kingdom of Israel in the north. And it was mainly Israel he was working with, the bigger kingdom, because they were having a good time. They were economically more powerful than they had ever been before. The country occupied more territory than even you can see on that map. They had conquered Damascus, which is over to the right, right up at the top there, and taken over lots of Syrian territory as well. They were powerful. It was a big and prosperous country. And yet, you know, in the Bible, the king of Israel in those days, Jeroboam II, hardly gets a mention. Why? Because he was a pretty evil king. And although they were doing well, and there was prosperity there, and all the archaeological artifacts we've dug up from that period show just how well off a country it was a country where there was no social justice. The rich were getting richer, and the poor were getting poorer all the time. A bit like the world today. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when Henry Kissinger was saying, it's the US's aim to end world poverty within a decade. The poverty gap must be brought together. Well, 10 years later, the poverty gap had just widened, and so it's gone on. And in the get-rich-quick society of the early 21st century, the gap is just growing between the top and the bottom. Well, that's exactly what was happening in Israel in those days. And if you read the prophet Amos, who prophesied at the same time as Hosea, you'll see just how unjust and corrupt the country actually was. It was doing fine at one level, but inside, there was an awful lot that was wrong with it, and God was not pleased with that country. And they were proud of their independence. We've conquered all this territory. We've built a strong country. And they were ignoring the fact that actually to do it, they'd put themselves in hock to big powers like Assyria, who one of these days were going to swallow up their country. So they felt so independent, so free, so powerful, and yet they'd sold their soul to people who were going to destroy them. And God could see all of this happening, just as he could see Gomer's life going downhill. And it broke his heart because they were his people. And what broke his heart probably more than anything else was that the country was characterized by what I've called here do-it-yourself religion. What does that mean? Well, basically, it was down in the south, in the yellow blob, that the Israelites were supposed to come to worship God. But the independent north had broken away from the south, so they couldn't go down there to Jerusalem any longer. So they built their own shrines. They built their own liturgy. They built their own ceremonies and sacrifices. They were still worshipping God, but they were worshipping him in a way that they had designed. They'd put him in a box. They'd worked out what they wanted to do with God. They'd go this far, but no further. And so they had a very convenient religion that suited them. And who cares whether it suited God or not? And so they'd gone a long way away, just as Gomer had, from the relationship she was supposed to have. And God was saying, through what Hosea was doing with Gomer, this is how I feel about my people. I have a love for them, which is absolutely scandalous. I loved them in the first place, even though I knew they were a bad proposition. I knew what would happen. I'm God. I know the end from the beginning. But I still thought it was worth creating them. I still thought it was worth picking them out of the nations. I still thought it was worth making them my people. And I've bought them back many, many times. And one of these days, I'm going to buy them back again. And in chapter 2, just before the verses we read, he thinks like this. In that day, I will respond. I'll respond to the skies and they'll respond to the earth. The earth will respond to the grain, the new wine and the olive oil. I'll plant her for myself in the land. I'll show my love to the one I called not my loved one. I will say to those called not my people, you are my people. And they will say, you are my God. I'm going to allure her. I'll lead her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. I'll give her back her vineyards. I'll make the valley of mourning a door of hope. There she will respond, as in the days of her youth, as in the days she came up out of Egypt. It's a love story. God not only took them on, God bought them back. And third thing that Hosea did, remember, was to say that Gomer could come and live with him. They'd rebuild and heal the relationship. And in the same way, God brought his people home. Or he was prophesying he was going to bring his people home. Now with Israel, sadly, that really didn't happen. They never came back to God in the way that God wanted them to. But it was all part of something bigger anyway. Because God was using Israel, not because they were special, wonderful, cuddly Near Eastern people. God was using them as a vehicle to reach the whole world. And in the New Testament, with the coming of Jesus at Christmas, you start to see that plan working out. The people who were not God's people, because they weren't Israelites, are invited into the family of God. And you begin to realize it's far wider than just this scrubby little kingdom or the one in the south. It's the whole of the world. And the Jews are important because they were the vehicle through whom God's love came to the ends of the earth. And so what God's saying to all of us through this whole story is, listen, I took you on even when you weren't worth it. I knew what I was going to get. I knew what a rotten bargain you would be, but I still had you. And when you'd let me down and walked away from me and been proud of your own selfish independence, I bought you back. That's what Christmas is about. The baby in the manger. Jesus coming down to earth for us. Richard Crashaw in the 17th century, put it like this. Welcome all wonders in one sight. Eternity shut in a span. Summer to winter, day and night, heaven and earth, and God in man. Great little one, whose all-embracing birth lifts earth to heaven, stoops heaven to earth. When Jesus came down into that manger, it was God himself in human form, eternity shut in a span. And God himself walked here on earth in the form of Jesus and 33 years later died on a cross. So that you and I could be forgiven, bought back, and not just bought back, but brought home, brought into God's family, given a whole new start, get to know a love that never gives up and never walks out on us. And that's what makes being a Christian so exciting. It's a scandalous love. It's the kind of love we could never deserve, could never pay for, the kind of love that shouldn't be shown. But as Ariel McRae's story shows, love comes up in some funny places and expresses itself in some funny ways. And the love of God was prepared to go to the limit for us, to go as far as it needed to, just to bring us back home again. So much bigger than any of the other stories you can tell about Christmas, isn't it? This is from Miracle on 34th Street, which our home group watched the other week. It's a great Christmas story about this old guy who gets a job as Santa in a store. And, well, is he the real Santa or is he not? It's hard to tell right through to the end of the movie. But little girl Natalie Wood, who plays him, actually, she was 8 years old at the point, and she hadn't yet sorted out what she thought about Father Christmas. And she was convinced until the end of the movie, until they'd finished making it and they were having the wrap party when all the actors get together at the end of the thing, she was convinced that this was the real Father Christmas who was just acting a part in the movie. And what you get in Miracle on 34th Street is great, but it's a Santa story. It's about somebody who loves the good people. If you're a good boy or girl, you get presents. If you're a bad boy or girl, it doesn't work out that way. Fairly brutal when you think about it. And there have been lots of stories like that down through the ages. In the Middle Ages, for instance, in Austria and Hungary, there was the story of Perchta, who was a kind of half evil spirit, half wandering angel, and she was supposed to come to people's homes during the 12 days of Christmas, and she would inspect whether children had been good and whether certain servant girls had woven all the flax they were supposed to spin in the course of the year. If they had, she left a small silver coin for them. If they hadn't, she ripped open their bodies, took out the intestines, and put stones and straw in there instead. Yeah, you try telling that story to my grandchildren. But you see, it's ghoulish, it's horrible, but it's the same thing, isn't it? You do good, I love you. You do bad, I don't. And that's not the gospel story. That's not the Christmas story. Sadly, a lot of people think that Miracle on 34th Street is great because it's Christmas without Jesus. Here's one review of it. There is nothing religious about the movie. While the action centers on the figure associated with Christmas, Jesus is never alluded to. We're not told, as Charlie Brown and Linus make a point to every year, that the meaning of Christmas involves three wise men in the manger and shepherds keeping watch over the flocks. No, Miracle on 34th Street taps into something non-denominational and universal. What a sad comment. Christmas is better without Jesus. And when you think about the difference in the two stories, Santa Claus loves you if you're good. Jesus loves you scandalously, whoever you are. I know which story I prefer to listen to, quite honestly. Or think of A Christmas Carol, Charles Dickens, great novel, tremendous Christmas story. But really, what's it about? This old miser, Scrooge, who is terrified into being good to his family and buying them a goose for Christmas by a succession of ghosts that show him a bit about himself. And all of his love is spent on his family, on cutesy Tiny Tim, who's, you know, the most controversial thing he ever says is, God bless us, everyone! And he's cute, he's nice, it's not difficult giving him presents. Very, very difficult going to buy Gomer back from her pimp. Very difficult loving you and me with some of the stuff that we've got inside us, the rebellious instincts, the thoughts, the things we've done that wake us up with shame in the middle of the night, the stuff that human beings, normal human beings do, means that God should never have sent Jesus as he did, but he did. His is a love that just does not give up and keeps on going. And you find in the lives of Christians down through the ages that same love showed to other people. This is Father Damien, Belgian priest who in the 19th century just prayed every morning that his superiors would send him out to the mission field because he wanted to reach people that just had not been reached by the message of the gospel yet. And he was sent eventually to Hawaii and volunteered for service on an island on which lepers were put by themselves in quarantine. And the kingdom of Hawaii didn't have enough money to look after them properly, so they were just left there basically to die. Damien lived there for 40 years. He dug their graves. He tended their wounds himself with his own bare hands. He shared meals with them. And you didn't use forks and knives. You just ate it with your hands. He was almost dooming himself to catch leprosy, and so he did. And 40 years after he arrived, he died of what he'd helped other people to fight for so many years. And he transformed that whole place. He knew when he went there, if he stayed, it was a death sentence, and he went anyway. Scandalous love. This is Copenhagen Harbour in Denmark. And from there in the 17th century, these two young guys, Dober and Nitschmann, went out to be missionaries in the islands of St. Croix and St. George in the Caribbean. And they knew that on those islands, nobody could come unless they were slaves. And so they were prepared. They didn't have to do it in the end, but they were prepared to sell themselves into slavery and live as slaves for the rest of their life, just so that other slaves around them could hear the gospel. As it was, they got to the islands, they managed to ply their own trade. They weren't enslaved, because white people weren't enslaved, they found out when they got there. But because of their love, because they were prepared to give anything just to pursue those people who'd never heard about Jesus, churches were planted very quickly. People became Christians because they saw there a scandalous love that just drew them in. The Apostle Paul said this to Christians in the early days. In 2 Corinthians he wrote, "For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that you through his poverty might become rich." That's what scandalous love does. It denudes itself. It strips itself. It makes itself poor so that others can become rich. And as Dober and Nitschmann were rowed out from the shore at Copenhagen to the boat that was to take them to the Caribbean, they waved back to the people standing at the quay who'd come to see them off, and Nitschmann shouted words that have gone down in history. "May the Lamb that was slain," he shouted, "receive the due reward for his sacrifice." The Lamb who was slain, that means Jesus, obviously. The due reward for his sacrifice, that means other people who are prepared to follow in the same path, live the same pattern, love other people as much as he did. And through Dober and Nitschmann and people like them, Father Damien, all sorts of people down through the centuries, Christians have done that kind of stuff. And so the challenge of this morning to us is pretty simple, isn't it? Are we prepared this Christmas to give back to Jesus, to the birthday boy, by scandalous acts of love that just show the love of Jesus in action in places where we're going to get no reward? Nothing's going to come back to us for it, but we're just going to show that there exists in the universe a love that cannot be contained within formulas, within stories about Christmas and Santa and Scrooge, but goes way beyond the limits and just spendthrift love that gives itself to everybody that needs it. The Hound of Heaven. This is a guy called Francis Thompson, who lived in the 19th century in Preston in Lancashire. Son of a wealthy man who was a doctor. He was groomed to be a doctor himself. He went to Owens College in Manchester, which is now Manchester University, had an excellent education, did 6 years of learning to be a doctor there, and then decided he didn't want to do it. He wanted to go to London and become a writer instead. And so he did. Unfortunately, times were hard, and he became addicted to drugs too, which didn't help. So for 3 years, and this is a picture of him at the end of it, he lived in absolute poverty on the streets of Whitechapel. If a local prostitute hadn't taken pity on him and taken him in, he'd probably have died by the roadside. But for 3 years, he was in the grip of his drug habit, and he was doing nothing very much. And then, by some miracle, people discovered that he could write. And he was picked up by some of the greatest literary figures of his day, taken off to Sussex, rehabilitated, helped to kick the drugs, and for the rest of his life, he lived for about a decade after that, he produced some great poetry. But there's one poem for which he's always remembered, and it's called The Hound of Heaven. Because part of that whole thing of being taken up from the streets and taken back and sorted out was that in the process, Francis Thompson became a Christian. And if he hadn't, perhaps he wouldn't have had the willpower to kick the drugs. He certainly felt that coming to know the living God that he'd been running away from for years on the streets of London, coming to know the living God had changed his life. And so he wrote this poem. And the poem starts like this. It talks about God as a hound that's tracking him down, like Hosea trying to track down Gomer. And he says, "I fled him down the nights and down the days. I fled him down the arches of the years. I fled him down the labyrinthine ways of my own mind. And in the midst of tears I hid from him, and under running laughter. And he goes on in the poem, 189 lines of it, to talk about all of the different ways he tried to hide from God, run away from him, just say, no, 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 I want to be independent. I want to be free. I want to be on my own. And in the end, God gets him in a corner and he realizes he can't run away any longer. And the poem ends like this. Jesus says to him, all which I took from thee, I did but take not for thy harms, but just that thou mightst seek it in my arms. All which thy child's mistake fancies as lost, I've stored for thee at home. Rise, clasp my hand, and come. Halts by me that footfall? Is my gloom, after all, shade of his hand outstretched caressingly? And then the Lord speaks again, ah, fondest, blindest, weakest, I am he whom thou seekest. Thou dravest love from thee who dravest me. What were you running away from all this time? I love you. You've had your back turned to the love that can heal you and make you whole again. My scandalous love is what you need. Bring that one up to date. Kirsten Powers is one of the leading political columnists in America. She has a column in Newsweek magazine every month, and she is a pretty acid commentator. She's a Democrat. She's one of the women that Donald Trump is not going to find falls over for him very easily. And she says, of all people surprised that I became an evangelical Christian, I'm the most surprised. Why? Because she grew up in a very intellectual atmosphere. Her father, a well-known archaeologist, went to an Episcopal church every Sunday, and so she kind of believed a little bit because he believed. She'd had no convictions of her own, but he was smarter than her, and if he believed in God, then that was all right. Didn't survive university, though, because she got in with a liberal, left-leaning crowd who didn't have much time for God or religion, and bit by bit, any faith she had had disappeared. And she became a pretty hard-boiled atheist. In fact, just before she started going out with the guy who eventually led her to Christ, she was asked by a friend, is there anybody you wouldn't go out with? And she said, well, not somebody who believes in God. Then a month later, she found she was doing. She'd met this boy. And he introduced her to a church in New York City, where she found, she'd never been to church for years and years, but she found the preacher was quite upsetting. He was a fellow called Timothy Keller, and he talked in an intellectual kind of a way that she could understand. And he started to show her that the atheism on which her life was started had all kinds of intellectual problems. And she began to believe that Christians were idiots, but then so were atheists too, so where does that leave us? And in the end, she couldn't make up her mind. The boyfriend eventually left her, but she kept on going to the church. And in the end, she was advised to go to a Bible study group led by Kathy Keller, the church's minister, the minister's wife. And in Kathy Keller's Bible study, and she thought only weirdos went to Bible studies, she was just stunned by what happened to her. And she said she came out and stood there in the streets on New York's East Side and said, it's all true. It's all true. And she became a Christian. And she couldn't believe what she'd done, and so her old prejudices came back, and she said she spent the next few weeks trying to get away from it. She said this about her pre-Christian experience. Just 7 years ago, if someone had told me that I'd be writing for Christianity Today magazine about how I came to believe in God, I'd have laughed out loud. If there was one thing in which I was completely secure, it was that I would never adhere to any religion, especially to evangelical Christianity, which I held in particular contempt. And then all of this happened to her. And she tried to get away from it and stop it, but she said, I spent the next few months doing my best to wrestle away from God. It was pointless. Everywhere I turned, there he was. Slowly there was less fear and more joy. The hound of heaven had pursued me and caught me, whether I liked it or not. That's the scandalous love that God has for us. And I guess the challenge for most of us this morning, because we know about it, we've experienced it in our own lives, is what are we prepared to do to take that love out somewhere this Christmas and just pass it on to somebody else? Are you looking for a chance to do that? There may be something else to say, though, just before I finish and Michelle comes in just to think about all of this. Miracle on 34th Street has been shown 47 times now at Christmas on American TV. All the networks show it every year. This one gets shown at Christmas too, the Charlie Brown Christmas program. And this has been shown every year since 1965. Yeah, it's got all the characters in it. Peppermint Patty, Beethoven, Linus, Snoopy. And you always know Linus, don't you? How do you know Linus? the blanket. That's it. He's always carrying that blanket he's got there. And you know, somebody noticed recently, a guy who's a writer and a musician, that there is only one point in the whole of everything that Charles Schulz, the cartoonist, has ever done where Linus drops his blanket. He's always holding it except at one moment, and that's in the Christmas show. That's the moment. And it's when Linus is telling the story of Jesus from Luke chapter 1, and the angel says, "Fear not." And the blanket just drops to the ground. Okay, he spoils it by picking it up again. But you can see what Schulz is trying to say. And the writer says this, looking at it now, it's pretty clear what Charles Schulz was saying, and it's so simple, it's brilliant. The birth of Jesus separates us from our fears. The birth of Jesus frees us from the habits we're unable or unwilling to break ourselves. The birth of Jesus allows us to simply drop the false security we've been grasping so tightly and learn to trust and cling to him instead. And if you've never really experienced the scandalous love of Jesus Christ, I wonder if it's time you drop the blanket.